Petersfield's Shine Radio.
This is Talking Books, presented by Susie Wild and Tim O'Kelly.
Hello, I'm Susie Wild, and you're listening to Talking Books.
And I'm Tim O'Kelly of One Tree Books.
Well, this is our special summer reading edition with recommendations for what's out now.
And what's coming in the next month, when Susie and I are taking a break.
Certainly, this month we have a good one, Tim. I spoke to award-winning author and all-round good egg, Barbara Henderson.
Fantastic, looking forward to that.
It's really good. Now, she writes for children and adults, and one of the reasons I wanted her on in June is she's judging the PECAN writing competition, the fiction
Just
section.
Just tell everyone what PECAN is, in case they don't
PECAN,
know.
PECAN, very well, good point, is the Petersfield Climate Action Network.
Thank you.
And at the Eco
get a good,
Fair...
Get a plug-in for them, it's good. They're a very good outfit, so it's good to get a plug-in for them.
I'll get a plug-in for One Tree Books as well, who are offering the prizes. Anyway, we've got last month's interviewee, Roger Morgan Grenville, is going to be judging the non-fiction aspect and Barbara the fiction. But much more of that at the end of this edition. What do you reckon? Shall we crack on with the recommendations?
Yeah, some really interesting good books for your summer reading pack. Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld.
Oh, yes.
Now, she did Rodham most recently, a sort of fictionalised version of Hillary Clinton's life. What could have happened if she hadn't decided to get married to Bill? And it's an absolute crack movie. But this is quite different. It's a sort of, I call itself a romantic comedy, and it sort of is. It's about a writer who on a comedy programme in the US called Sally Miltz. And she's very, very funny, but she's not a model. You know, she's not a supermodel. She's just a brilliant, brilliant, funny woman writer, and her theory is that men who are sort of ordinary looking, shall we say, who are very funny and creative writers, always end up with these amazingly glamorous partners, and but it doesn't work the other way around. So of course it does in this story. So that's the theory, and it's a really cracking read and full of humour and intelligence.
That's a good choice for a summer read, Tim.
That's a good summer read. Something a bit different is My Father's House by Joseph O'Connor. So it's set in occupied Rome in 1943. It's based on a true story. A young priest, an Irish priest, gets involved in the escape line of Allied prisoners of war, mainly pilots, who have been shot down in Italy and are trying to escape either from prisoner of war camps or just trying to get out of the country. And it runs through the Vatican, because the Vatican is the only place in Rome that is not got an occupying force. Because It's another country. It was surrounded by soldiers and secret police and everything, but not actually inside it. So he had to get them in there and then out again. That's the thing. But it's got quite an entertaining literary thriller, really. So
it is a
that.
Thriller. Is it,
yeah,
is
yeah.
It's thriller
it's,
style.
It's exciting, but it's not pure excitement. It's quite a lot going on there. And he did Star of the Sea. I don't know if you remember that, about 15, 20 years ago. He's also actually fun enough. Anyway, that definitely worth reading that one.
Okay.
Tom Lake by Anne Patchett. This is one of my favourites in hardback last year.
Yeah.
It's three daughters of this family arrive back during the pandemic. They're also adults, grown adults, and they come back and they beg their mum to retell the story of what happened at Tom Lake. Tom Lake is a place. When their mother met this became this amazing film star, but before that he wasn't anybody, and they had a kind of the first love affair, and so what happened with them, and it's a beautifully told story of parents having a real love life in the past, and it's also about the love within the family. It's really beautifully done, really really lovely book. And
are there several points of view in it, or is it just...
No, it's really told from Lara, the mother, who tells the story of of her passionate affair.
I missed that first time, so I might have definitely, to put the paper back.
Definitely worth that. In stark contrast, In Memoriam by Alice Wynne, which is set on the Western Front during the First World War, and it's pretty grueling, but it's got great pace to it. So it's the story of two people, Henry Gaunt and Sidney Elwood, who are both schoolboys at their public school together, and they watch, they read them in the school magazine every week of another whole drove of people that have been killed, and they decide it's their duty to go out there. So they end up going out young before they're called up and leave school separately. They're a bit different, slightly different age. But they also have a kind of love story going on at the same time between these two, and it's amazing, an amazing story. Again, another contrasting to that is Richard Osman's The Last Devil to Die, which is the fourth part in the Thursday Murder Club series, and to my mind the best of the four, I think.
Read it as a standalone?
I think you'd want to start at the beginning, probably. But I would recommend this. I enjoy the Thursday Murder Club series. Not everyone's cup of tea. They're quite light. They're very witty, I'd say, rather than funny. There's plenty of humour there. This one is particularly moving as well. So I would really recommend that. Then the last, I've got two non-fiction books to talk about as well. Wave Walker, but they're both actually to do with the sea. Wave Walker by Suzanne Heywood. So this is the story of this woman who, when she was a girl, aged, I think, 8, her parents said, "It's really exciting, Sue. We're going to go away around the world in a boat, have this amazing adventure," and both her parents were teachers, and she thought, "Oh, well, this is quite exciting, but I'm a bit worried about it." So what about school? So don't worry about that, you know, it'll be fine. Anyway, her and her younger brother, who's a year younger than her, sail, starts to go around the world. It's not for 10 years till they finally get back, when she wins a place at Oxford University to study zoology, which has become her passion. But during that 10 years away, she's desperately trying to... seeking education and failing to get it from her parents, failing to get it from anywhere else. And it's an extraordinary story of resilience, and but also a really interesting story about what it's like to sail around the world back in 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So without the tech that we have now, at one stage their compass gets smashed in a storm, and they're in the middle of nowhere. And they're in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, and they have to work out. They've managed to find a little compass in a reserve somewhere, in a drawer somewhere, and it's not plumbed in prop to the metal of the ship and all that sort of stuff, and they're in the South Atlantic, so it's too near the pole to be that accurate. Anyway, but so lots of adventures, and especially if people are interested in sailing.
So I'm going to read that book now, finally.
You have to, yeah.
Say again what the name is.
Wave Walker.
Wave Walker, because it doesn't sound like the name of
the boat.
Ah, oh, okay, got you. Right, brilliant.
And it is it's a pretty extraordinary story, really. So the other book is again, as I alluded to already, it's going to be The Wager, which is a book about set in, well, it's a true story, but it's 1742, a British Navy ship leaves as part of a group of ships to go all the way round across the Atlantic and all the way around to the other side of the Pacific coast of South America, on a secret mission to dish the Spanish, basically, and to raid a treasure galleon that they know is going to be there. They don't understand about scurvy, so by the time they actually get right down to the bottom of South America, they're all incredibly ill. They've gone at the wrong time of year because they don't understand that the summer is actually far worse for storms in the South Atlantic, and they don't understand also really the geography. They don't understand quite where they have to go. They've got some very basic charts. The result is that they end up shipwrecked, and the party divides into two. There's a the captain has a small group around him, and there's a sort of one of the crew is sort of appoints himself to be a kind of leader, and they both decide, I won't say what happens, but they end up in different places escaping from this, from where they are, where the shipwrecked. And it is tremendously exciting, and it's a true story. It's really extraordinary. So that's
And if
wager.
You're feeling miserable about your holiday cottage let or whatever, if you just even read the beginning of that book, I guarantee you'll think you're in luxury, won't you? Because the living conditions on those old vessels were horrific.
Extraordinary.
And it's David Gran, isn't it, the
David
author?
Gran. So that's The Wager, a tale of shipwreck, mutiny and murder.
Tim, I think you've done really well. And one of the points I'm going to pick up from is the Richard Osman book, and you saying it's probably best to read from the beginning.
Yes.
And I think one of the joys of summer reading is that you have more time, and I'd absolutely get behind that. The series, well, the two series actually that I'm going to recommend, and I'm going to keep it very, very simple because, you know, we haven't got oceans of time in the summer, have we? But I would say, if you don't read Richard Osman, you might try Dead on Dartmoor by Stephanie Austin. Now, I've mentioned her before, and it's another one where I've recommended it to friends and said, well, I don't know whether you'll like it or not, and they have absolutely loved it. Right. It is that they are whodunits, but it's a fantastic heroine called Juno. She's feisty, but in a relatable way. It's not absurd. And Richard has been reading them as well, my husband, and has laughed out loud. Good. And believe me, that takes something. So so that's one series. And the other series is my beloved Mick, well, everybody's beloved Mick Herron. And I read the first couple, and then I realised I hadn't actually kept up with the reading as they've come off the production line. I had gone on to read other things. But because it's been on Apple TV, and if you haven't seen it, it is miraculous with Gary Oldman. I think in some ways, the first book, Slow Horses, is even better on the television, and it will certainly give you a kick start into it, because mm-hmm. I remember when people said, oh, it's a story about the Secret Service and they've all failed, they're all hopeless, and I thought, oh, who wants to read about that? And of course they're not, they have addictions, but they're actually quite good at what they do secretly.
Yeah, I mean they've all failed in different ways.
Yes.
And our main character, River Cartwright, has failed because he's been set up to fail by somebody else. So he's the victim of a yes. setup, and it's not his fault that he's failed. But the others, as I said, most of the others have cocked up in some way.
Often through, because they're trying too hard, and they do have the good of the country behind.
So I agree. It's a great show. I've just started the third TV series, which is
I think
fun.
It is really good. So I'd really, really strongly recommend reading. That's the Slough House series by Mick Herron. I'm going to also talk about one of the other things for summer reading is, because you have time, not just getting stuck into a series, which I think is brilliant. It's a way you can never normally do till somebody has a tranche of books. But the other thing is reading really thick books. And this isn't necessarily one to take on the beach, but it's A Curious History of Sex by Kate Lister. And it's recommended to me by somebody who's doing a PhD in particularly sex in the Victorian age, which fascinated me when I was doing my English degree, because, you know, it's absolutely not in the Victorian era as we think it was. And this has been published by Unbound, my publishers. So I'd recommend that people get the hardback, because the paper is beautiful, the ink is beautiful, the illustrations, the photographs, the paintings within it are supremely done, though it is available also in paperback. But honestly, she is so erudite.
Okay.
I really recommend it.
And
the final one is a nod to everybody's dear Michael Mosley, Dr. Michael Mosley, who has recently died. And the number of people I've talked to who are strangely moved by that in a way that none of us can really understand why. Mm. I think he did have that knack as well, though, of feeling as if you were his friend. And obviously, as a sensible person. You're very aware you're not. He's a broadcaster. But he had that knack of speaking to you as if he was only speaking to you and not to the millions who loved him. And on Times Radio, certainly, they've been deluged by people saying how much he's helped their health and so on.
Sure.
And I think by doing it himself, and like Claire Bailey's wife said recently, I still have to hide the biscuits from him. So my summer read for people, if certainly if they want to get beach fit, is the Fast 800 recipe book. It's actually written by his wife, Claire Bailey, and it works. That's what everybody's saying. It works. And it's delicious food.
Okay, right here.
So there we are.
So, writing predominantly for children, Barbara has written many books, from the book The Highland Clearances novel, Fur for Luck, all the way through to a Viking adventure, The Chessman Thief. Her latest book is Rivet Boy, about a young Victorian breadwinner employed on the construction site of the iconic Forth Bridge. She's twice won the Historical Association's Young Quills Award. Her titles for adults to date include the immigration memoir Scottish by Inclination and Made from Girders, a look behind the scenes at the Forth Bridge.
Very good. It was as if Ian Rankin was in the room.
She's the writer in residence at the Forth Bridge. It's a lovely idea to have a writer in residence at the Forth
Bridge.
I know,
it's hilarious. I picture her in a hammock up there.
Fantastic.
Actually, she's since then, she has just got a new book out, and she's going to be doing a reading from it towards the end of this, which is fantastic, but more of that anon. So Barbara and I talked about her book Wilderness Wars, Nature's Wild Places, and Norse and Celtic History. I wonder why she also loves my books as I love hers. But anyway, here we go, Barbara's interview. Well, I'm super excited because I have got the lovely Barbara Henderson here on Zoom so I can see her. And I haven't seen Barbara for about 10 years since we were at a Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators thing together. Barbara, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Yes, excellent. I'm right in the north of Scotland in Inverness near Loch Ness. So lovely to touch base with you again, Susie.
That's brilliant. Now, listeners will know that I'm speaking to you because you kindly agreed to be fiction judge for our inaugural writing competition. Deadline, 30th of June, everybody. Get writing if you're aged between 7 and 16. And I asked Barbara especially because I love her writing, but there was a book that really spoke to me. I'm surprised it was your third book. I actually thought it was much further along than that. But no, I did note. And it's called Wilderness Wars. And I thoroughly recommend it to everybody. But I'm going to hand over to Barbara to say a bit more about it.
Right, of course. So Wilderness Wars asks the question, what if nature fights back? And I might just read you a tiny bit of the blurb on the back. It says, still in the days, I take it all in. The wind, the leaden skies, the churning moody sea, and far in the distance, a misty outline. Skelsey, wilderness haven, building site, luxury retreat to be, and now home. So it's about a girl whose father is tasked with overseeing a building project on an uninhabited island. And it begins with small mishaps, the little things that adults can easily explain away. But for the children, it soon becomes clear that there's a pattern emerging. The island is fighting back. Nature is on the warpath. And actually, the aggressor are the incomers. You know, that's the thing that, interested me about the whole project. You know, who are we to mess with these, age old balances and ecosystems and so on? So, yeah, there were quite a lot of things that sort of played into my inspiration. Will I tell you about that?
Let me just first, before you go on to that, let me say that the opening that I loved you reading with your accent. It's the way to read the book. I might actually ask you to read a bit for our, because we always do an extract, which I normally read, but I might ask you to and send
very
it.
Very happy to do it.
But listen, Barbara, when I began reading it, that trip over on the ferry to the island and the gulls attacking, no spoiler because this is really early in the book, reminded me of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. And I loved the way you just flipped that. So I was expecting, oh, you know, because I never read the blurb, I hate reading the blurb on things first. So I was expecting, oh, look at this lot being the enemy, when in fact, it's flipped. We are the enemy. And I loved it. So now tell me what on earth made you think of it that way?
It began, there's a few aspects that really played into it. So I was already a writer. I had two books published and I always have a notebook with me, like most people, I suppose, who write books. And we were going on holiday. So we were driving along a coastal route, very, very remote, no other car in sight, either, neither before us nor behind us. And we had our three children in the back of the car. Our dog was in the boot and we were just driving. And yeah, interestingly, out of nowhere, a stone hit our windscreen and it cracked it. It was a small crack, it was a small stone, but still it gave us a fright enough to kind of, you know, give a little skid and a little wriggle off the steering wheel. And we came to a halt and inspected the damage. And once we realized that it wasn't going to stop us from traveling on, it was quite a small, minor thing. Yeah, we sort of made light of it in that slightly embarrassed, I got a fright and I probably shouldn't have overreacted like that sort of way. And, you know, I just remember saying, oh, you know, that was a stone that hit our windscreen. And the kids were saying, who threw the stone? Oh, the birds over there, you know, the seagulls circling over our car. Maybe they threw the stone. Yeah, maybe they don't want us to go to the holiday cottage. And my husband said, whoa, nature fights back. And I remember thinking, oh, that's catchy. I'm going to write that in my book. And I did. And it didn't sort of leave me alone. I have like approximately 75 ideas a day. So therefore,
Wow.
I need to really whittle down what ideas have a bit of mileage in them. But if they stay with me, then I'm thinking, we could think about this some more. So I wondered what nature would fight back against. So at the time we were living in Aberdeenshire and a certain Donald J. Trump
Oh.
was going through the process of applying for permission to build a luxury resort to the north of Aberdeen. And there were a lot of us who were not in favour of this and did some campaigning. But, you know, money talks and he got through. And yeah, I just thought it was such a crying shame to bulldoze over these dunes that you could never replicate, you know, to mess with ecosystems that you could never restore to their original balance. I was worried about that. So yeah, I suppose that was something that nature could fight back against. And then I was also a leader at the time, one of the leaders of the local RSPB junior club. It's called Wildlife Explorers. So, you know, taking kids pond dipping and bird watching and, you know, building nest boxes and all this sort of stuff that you do to connect young people with nature. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely if this book could actually do the same? Connect young people with the natural world a little more. And so that was my sort of heart reason for wanting to write it. However, I also was a new mum at the time that this idea first really took hold. And yeah, I guess I watched this program called Castaway, which the
Oh,
older ones of
yes.
you might remember. It was a BBC turn of the millennium type of program, kind of one of the earliest reality TV shows, really, where they would pluck people from all sorts of walks of life who'd volunteered for this, and they would put them on an uninhabited island to fend for themselves, build a community. And they gave them the essentials to survive and left them to it, really, and filmed. And I was just mesmerized by the beauty of this island, Tarransay. And I thought, well, if I'm going to hang out anywhere in my head, it might as well be a place like that. So even though Skelsey, my fictional island, is made up completely, it is based, I suppose, on the nature, on the wildlife that you would get in the Western Isles, which is a place that I love.
And how does the Donald Trump aspect come into it? Because I love the way it's, you know, really relatable to your heroine, M.
Yeah, no, I suppose, you know, this idea that somebody rich could come in and dictate what happens on this beautiful remote spot, that's you know, that's taken. But I didn't want to just settle for a sort of semi-lazy American multimillionaire comes in, billionaire even, I suppose, comes in and imposes this. So I wanted it to be a British group. So it's a London-based company, a sort of developer of luxury resorts, and they want to build this this resort on the Isle of Skelsey. So the idea is that the remoteness would be the attraction, but you would have, you know, glass buildings, maximizing the view, and you know, a funicular railway going up the bend, the one peak on the island, and so on. So I had fun kind of designing in my head and imagining what it might look like. And one of the most common classroom activities actually is kids, you know, developing a prospectus, or you know, doing some drawings of what they think this resort might be intended to look like. Of course, we never quite get to that because there are lots of problems along the way, and the children spot the danger way before the adults do.
I think it's really good that it's her father who's so instrumental in a way in the destruction. He's got a foot in both camps. And I love the fact, as usual, that you've got such a, as usual for your writing, you have such a brilliant, feisty girl, if you like, because she's just at that interesting, on the cusp of womanhood. I think that's a really interesting age. And girls obviously are always more mature than boys of a similar age. And she's the one who has the imagination, if you like, as well. She has the observation and the imagination to see what might be happening.
Yeah, no, I find Em really enjoyable to write. I like a girl with attitude. Actually, I like a boy with attitude. But Em in particular, I think my publishers were a tiny bit worried about this. They were saying, you know, maybe she's just a little bit too harsh on everybody, but she
Oh,
is a
she's
girl with a chip
wonderful.
on her shoulder. Her
Yeah.
father has run roughshod over a promise he made to her. So at the beginning of the book, she is raging, because she feels betrayed by her father, and you know, she signed up for a year or two on an uninhabited island without having all the information. He led her to believe that they would be friends, you know, girls her own age, and so on. And this transpires not to be true, and her dad didn't go out of his way to disabuse her of that na notion. So she feels betrayed, and so that's part of it. You know, she
And
feels
she's not
vulnerable.
unaware, is she? That's what I love about it. And there's a bit where she sort of said, why is she behaving like this when she
Yeah,
seems
yeah, yeah. No,
intends
she
to be
constantly has
bored?
this inward dialogue with herself. Like, why did I react like that? And I think that's a great thing for youngsters to see in fiction, is somebody to be self-aware and to actually be able to call herself out on behavior that probably isn't right. But there are a couple of shortcuts where, you know, she deeply cares about her brother, even though he is to her the most annoying creature on the planet. But when he's in trouble, oh my goodness, does she come good? And she's a very loyal, fiercely loyal, and incredibly courageous friend. And so all of that also comes into it. And you know, I certainly feel that there's a lot of myself in him. Yeah.
Oh yeah, a lot of all of us actually. The other aspect that I love about your writing is that you create jeopardy. You really always make us fear for the characters, and I think that's because they're so well-rounded. There aren't sort of classically minor characters, if you call it. They really come alive, and you care, but you also don't, or and you don't let us down. So you create, you build this tension, and then we live in that moment. That is such a
Yeah,
cool thing.
I'm a massive fan of a cliffhanger. I really love that myself. I find that I am drawn into the next part of the book as a writer, never mind as a reader, by cliffhangers. So that works for me. You know, I'm not your naturally, you know, gifted comedian. I like having a little bit of humor in there to lighten the mood, or to give your reader a break, I guess. But you know, that's not my superpower. I'm no David Walliams or, you know, whoever else writes funny books really well. There's some brilliant writers who
But you
do
really
that
make me
fantastically well.
laugh. I mean, you made me
Yeah.
laugh the minute I saw Snarl, who turns
Yeah,
out
I
to
do
be.
it. I do it. The snarl's the hamster, yeah, of course. And like, that's very Struan to call his hamster that. And yeah, Struan was a great character to write. And
Her young
half of
brother.
Struan's playbook, Struan's the little brother, yeah. Half of that is literally directly borrowed from real life when my son, who was an incredible handful, was growing up. So he's now an adult and studying, but oh my goodness, did he prove a rich mine for mining? That type of humor, because yeah, wherever the mishaps and the just the mischief was, that's where my son was too. So yeah, I loved the brother. He was one of my favorite characters, and I think actually that's borne out by all the school visits. All the kids really relate to the little brother too. My favorite bit is when he doesn't obey rules and finds himself bitten by a seal, and seals famously carry all sorts of bugs in their mouths. You really shouldn't go near seals, especially when they have young. Struan disregards this particular piece of information, but he turns his lengthy hospital stay into an opportunity to produce a comic called When Seals Go Bad, and I quite enjoyed having a bit of fun with that. So
That's wonderful. Well, I'm going to recommend that book, and I have done to loads of people. So, what's your latest that we can actually buy at the moment?
my latest is a historical adventure called The Boy, the Witch and the Queen of Scots.
Oh.
It's set during the reign of Mary, Queen of Scots, but early, not the tragic queen imprisoned, possibly wronged, possibly plotting,
The one we
executed.
know.
All of that comes much, much later. So I'm coming in as the queen sails back into Scotland, which is her rightful kingdom, from France, where she's been widowed. She was married to the crown prince there, who ascended to the throne, but then shortly afterwards contracted an infection and died. So there was no room for her anymore at the French court, and she essentially had no choice but to either marry elsewhere or go back to Scotland and take up the throne here. And that's what she did. And
What sort of
she
age
arrived.
was she?
She was 18. She was
Oh.
only 18 when she came. A beautiful,
Oh.
tall, lithe, graceful, and actually, by all accounts, a very charming personality. She was incredibly faithful to her servants, very generous to her servants. She was sporty. Nowadays, she'd probably be selected for the school team. She loved hunting, riding, and hunting with birds, in particular falconry, was her thing. She loved that. She had a couple of merlins that she is on record to have hunted with and loved very much. And that's why I decided to make my main character a falconer boy. So he's sent by his plotting, scheming Earl, who staged an early rebellion, to go and spy on the Queen. And of course, he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. He either spies or he dies. So lots of jeopardy again, no problem.
Oh, I love it. And does he fall a bit in love with her if she's only 18?
No, he's a bit young for that. So he's 12 and then
Oh,
13.
okay. Okay.
So probably not, but he does recognize there's a bit in the book where she rides up to Stirling Castle in the evening sun ahead of her progress, and there's this long train of carts and riders and litters and all this stuff. But she rides ahead, and the wind and the evening sun catches her hair, and he says, "Now I'm not surprised that the whole of the country is a little bit in love with this queen." And I think that is an accurate reflection. I think people would have felt like that on encountering Mary.
Well, it could be even more powerful, can't it? That sort of admiration, that almost
Yeah, it's
butterfly.
just an observation again of the world around him. And of course, she's a new queen into the country, although she's been technically named the monarch ever since she was 6 days old. She had to flee as a child as a result of the rough wooing. Henry VIII had a bit of a thing of wanting to force a marriage between her and his own son Edward, and then of course the Scots decided not to honour their hastily given promise to do that, and so he went to war, and years and years and years of this followed, called the rough wooing. Mary was evacuated, if you like, to France, brought up at the French court, married the French crown prince instead, and so Henry VIII wasn't around anymore by the time Mary returned, but it was Elizabeth, his daughter, who of course authorized her execution later. So it's that sort of time. We're talking Tudor times, Tudors and Stuarts. And I've always been fascinated by that time. I love Shakespeare. I love everything to do with that time. And yeah, I love history, to be fair. I think history is just the most interesting country of all.
Best stories.
I
Barbara,
think
it's
so.
been such a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much. And
Thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to be on your podcast, and I can't wait to see the entries to the competition as well.
absolutely. And I'll be back in touch as soon as they're in. Thank you so
Fantastic.
much.
Thank you so much, Susie. Bye bye.
So we won't be live here in July, Tim, but what have we got to look out for anyone who comes in the shop?
Okay, so a number of books are coming out in paperback, which I've enjoyed, or which just are big books. So The Theory of Not Quite Everything by Kara Nod is coming out in paperback. That's a sort of contemporary, how to describe it really. It's a sort of love story, but it's nicely done. Atlas, the story of Parsolt, which is the conclusion to the Seven Sisters series that Lucinda Riley started, and her son has finished off for her because she sadly died before she'd finished the last book in the series. He's called Harry Whittaker, but so that's going to be quite a big book when that comes out in paperback. Moscow X by David McCloskey. He did Damascus Station, and it was hugely feted. He's a ex-CIA spook, and he knows his stuff. And that's called Moscow X. That's coming
I
in
love
paperback.
Damascus
Yeah,
Station.
no, this is.
But and you've read it in hardback,
No, I haven't
haven't
read
you?
it.
Oh,
I
haven't
haven't read
you?
it yet. No, I'm looking forward to it.
Oh,
So that might be my summer reading.
absolutely, me too.
The Wind Knows My Name, the Isabel Allende's latest book, is just coming out in paperback as well. I've just started that, and I'm literally a couple of chapters in, but I'm looking forward to reading more of that. Pax by Tom Holland, which is his book about the Roman Empire. The basic theory of which is Pax, to get the Romana Pax, the Roman peace, you need sustained violence over a period of time, and
Sounds like
eventually that
1984.
things will
War is peace.
things that's I mean the Roman the Pax Romana didn't come about overnight just because everybody was nice to each other and traded olive oil and wine. It's because they had a great big shocking great big army that kept people in order. How to Read a Tree by Tristan Gooley, again
Yeah.
in stark contrast. We all want to know how to read a tree, and Tristan will tell us in paperback. A couple of books coming out in hardback. Sarah Pierce, so she did a book called Sanatorium a year or two ago, and her new book is called Wilds, and it's set in the Portuguese wilderness, and I think people will really enjoy that. It's got the sort of mysterious goings on in a in the back of this, in the middle of Europe, but it's still in a really isolated spot in the Portuguese national park in this forest. That's good. And one other book I wanted to mention was in hardback, The Exile by Patrick Worrell. He did a book called The Partisan, which I was raving about, which was his first novel a couple of years ago, and this is the kind of it's a sort of prequel to it, in fact, and it's set after the Second World War with an exiled Latvian who resistance fighter who is determined to carry on the fight against the Russians, and ends up in Paris trying to raise money. So that's The Exile by Patrick Worrell.
Excellent. There's some really good ones there, as ever. So come into One Tree Books and find them. So now we're going to have our reading, and who better to read than Barbara Henderson herself? So you've already heard her lovely soft Scottish accent. So her very latest book is The Boy, the Witch, and the Queen of Scots, and this was also picked by her. It's from the very beginning of chapter one.
Normally the sea fog seeps in slowly from afar. Not today. Today it presses on the port of Leith like mud pouring from the sky, filling crevices and corners, hiding every one and everything. Good. I won't be found. I must not be found. Master Lamb may be a good master to me yet. I fix my well-worn gauntlet onto my arm and sigh deeply, rehearsing my speech to the trader. My name is Alexander Bachen of Huntly. Merchant Andrew Lamb of Leith sends me. I'm to collect a bird from your shipment of hawks from the east. Here is the written agreement you signed with him last night. I am better with birds than with words. The sound of my steps on the cobbles is muffled. The fog would claim even that. Which way for the ship? A three-masted vessel with a crimson-striped flag, the master said. I sigh, everything is grey today. Tendrils of fog swirl above me, creeping into my collar and dampening both my skin and my spirit. I sense the sea rather than see it. Salty tang, damp wood, rotten fish, creaking ropes, metal scraping against metal on tall mast hinges. All the ships in port sway like ghostly galleons. The harbour is all but deserted this morning, with the fishing boat securely moored due to the weather. No one in their right mind would go to sea today. But what do I know? I am no Letha, and Edinburgh still feels like a foreign country. Find the ship, Alexander, go to it. But then, something catches my eye, a fainter shade of grey, a vessel less defined, but sailing into port. No, there are two galleys, and fine ones at that, though their bright paintwork is fog-muted to browns and greys. I can just about make out the people on deck, looking and leaning towards land, both ladies and men. Stop staring, Alexander. After all, it's nothing to do with me. I am about to turn away and search for the trader's ship once more when two loud cannon shots tear through the morning air, sending me stumbling. Recovering my balance, I watch as slowly the two ships edge towards the harbour side. My throat goes dry. Wait! Today's date is the 19th of August, in the year of our Lord, 1561. She isn't supposed to arrive for another week at least, so people say. But I am right. Emerging from the mist, I recognise the fluttering fabric of the royal standard. The Queen has come, and much earlier than anyone had expected.
So that's it, Tim, for another month. But everybody, please remember the youth writing competition. So if you have a child or a grandchild who's passionate about nature and aged between 7 and 16, Tim's got a poster in the shop all about it, or you can go to peacefulcan.org for full writing competition rules and entry form, and your name won't be on it because I'm one of the judges and I don't want to know who's written what, so nobody can tell whether it's boy or girl or whatever. By whatever I don't mean Labradors, and it will be brilliant. And the non-fiction is 250 words, and I've actually miraculously got the same rules as The Guardian, who do a young country diary every month. And so if you've entered that, you can just slot it straight to The Guardian if you wish. And the fiction is 400 words. You've had a little flavour of Barbara's writing, not to say that that matters, but, you know, really put us on the spot. And Roger and Barbara have given their own writing tips as well as mine. So get cracking.
Fantastic.
Closing date, I'll say again, is the 30th of June.
Wonderful. So it just remains to say, don't forget you can hear all of the old programmes online through wherever you get your podcasts from, really, whether Spotify or whatever. And we'll see you again after the summer.
All 46 of them, Tim.
46?
46
editions.
Sorry,
I thought it was 6 summers. I thought it was... I'm a little bit more than that, I'm afraid, Susie. Yeah.
So am I.
Yeah.
Tim, okay. That was great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That shine forever. And the brightest tunes of today. Great music and local information. Only from Petersfield's Shine Radio.